Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 11th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, regulating love and aggression with oxytocin, the origins of Oort cloud comets, and finding new evidence that Polynesians sailed to South America. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about mongoose culture, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
There are a lot of misconceptions about oxytocin, often called the bonding hormone.
It's the love drug. It's beautiful. It makes people generous. It has been called the moral molecule. And they tell me that.
Karsten de Drew is a professor of social and organizational psychology at the University of Amsterdam.
And they tell me, you know, we should spray it on rioting groups because then they become trusting of one another and they become benevolent and riots and heated conflict will disappear. And it's kind of annoying because it's so dead wrong. Oxytocin does not make people trusting everybody. No, it makes you trust your next kin, your close in-group members. And actually, it makes you more aggressive against people you don't trust or you have reason to see as out-group members.
And in a paper in this week's Science, De Drew and colleagues report the results of their experiments to back that up.
When we started our investigations, we had three hypotheses as to what could happen vis-a-vis the out-group.
These are the people who are not in your family, not on your team, and may even be your competitors.
One hypothesis, based on earlier research, you could argue that oxytocin makes you benevolent and generous towards anybody, in-group members and out-group members alike. If that hypothesis were true, we should find not only in-group love, but also reduced out-group hate compared to a placebo condition.
But they didn't.
Another hypothesis we had was that oxytocin is a more of an adaptive hormone that evolved and remains with us because it helps you bonding with the in-group. And bonding with the in-group also implies that you should defend your in-group against out-groups. If that hypothesis were true, we should find similar or even elevated levels of out-group aggression under oxytocin. And we found evidence for that second hypothesis. Now, an important discovery that we made that we did not anticipate in advance was that in the first two experiments, we did not see different levels of out-group hate between oxytocin and placebo groups.
But Drew says that may have been because of how the experiment was designed. In the first two experiments, out-group hate was a form of offensive aggression.
Where you really try to hurt the out-group, basically for territorial reasons. You want to derogate them, hurt them, make your own standing vis-a-vis the out-group higher. That we did not see. And then we looked in our third experiment at another possibility, and that is that oxytocin, compared to placebo, triggers what we call defensive aggression.
In all of these experiments, De Drew and colleagues were having participants play what's known in psychology as the intergroup prisoner's dilemma maximizing differences game, developed in part by Nir Halevi, who is not a part of the study. Halevi works at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
My colleagues and I developed this game primarily to disentangle in-group love from out-group hate and provide a behavioral measure of the motivations underlying individual participation in intergroup conflict.
But for this last experiment, to tease out offensive aggression from defensive aggression, De Drew had to make a change. Again, Nir Halevi.
So they used the game that we have developed in our own previous research, and I think that they made a wonderful use of this paradigm.
The change De Drew and colleagues made to the game was to create conditions in which there was reason to fear the outgroup.
And under high fear, we found effects for oxytocin, driving more aggression towards the outgroup. But when fear was low, when the outgroup's competitive behavior would have little impact on the in-group, we saw that oxytocin did not lead to elevated levels of aggression.
Now, this is a game, a financial game, and the fear here is fear of losing money, not the fear of being killed or being denied food, clothing, or shelter. In fact, each participant in the study only interacted with a computer.
people did not know their in-group members, they did not know their out-group members, they did not interact with them, they could not even see them. And by simply organizing people into this, these are your members and these are competing out-group members, but just saying that and having some financial consequences to that organization in a competitive sense, that already elicited this in-group love and out-group aggression tendencies that we observed.
And the oxytocin increased those tendencies.
By inducing oxytocin versus a placebo in another condition, those people who were given oxytocin actually displayed more of this trust and in-group benevolence, and at the same time, more out-group aggression. And because we have induced this oxytocin to some, but not other people, we were able to show that oxytocin actually triggers this chain of events, so to speak. And that's the basis for our conclusion that oxytocin really has a causal, as a driver of this in-group cooperation and out-group aggression.
At least in a group of males in a lab experiment playing a game. Again, Nir Halevi, who helped design the original game.
Because we know that intergroup conflict outside the lab involves hostilities that go well beyond what we usually see in the lab, so I think perhaps the discrepancy between what we see in lab experiments and what we know about the reality of intergroup conflict is one thing that should guide our future research in a sense.
And study author Karsten Didru strongly cautions against using these results to justify giving oxytocin to anyone, particularly soldiers or anyone going to war.
And again, these are laboratory experiments, but let's assume that it actually translates and generalizes to those more real-life conflicts. If you give soldiers oxytocin, this is our research, you would find two things. First, they would become more generous and self-sacrificing to their fellow soldiers, to their in-group. At the same time, they are more likely to launch a preemptive attack on the out-group, on the competing army. So basically, oxytocin not only leads to bonding within the in-group, which may make your own army stronger, but at the same time, it makes your army, your soldiers, more likely to launch a preemptive strike because they suspect out-group aggression and want to neutralize that. And once you do the preemptive strike, you will get an escalation of the conflict because the other side cannot do anything else but respond with a similar or even stronger attack back. So it's a tricky business to generate straightforward practical implications from these type of studies. Really, it advances theory, it advances our understanding of what humans do and when and why. And ultimately, this should lead to better understanding of how conflicts evolve, where they come from, and how we can manage and perhaps resolve them.
And this actually points to the way in which societies and states can reduce conflict.
Again, Nir Halevi from Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management.
And that's by allowing citizens, group members, to display in-group love independently of out-group aid, offering them the opportunity, for example, to contribute to the group through community service instead of having compulsory military service. I think that once we educate citizens that they can contribute to society through intra-group cooperation in non-competitive ways, in ways that do not threaten out-group members, reducing this fear will help resolve unnecessary costly conflict.
You can read the paper by Didru and colleagues titled "The Neuropeptide Oxytocin Regulates Parochial Altruism in Intergroup Conflict Among Humans" in this week's Science. Researchers are working with the government of Brazil to return decades-old blood samples to the Amazon's Yanomamo Indians. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The planned return of the samples comes soon after the settlement of a lawsuit by Arizona's Havasupai Indians, who questioned the ethics of researchers at Arizona State University who collected and studied blood samples from the tribe. The Brazilian Yanomamo tribe began seeking the return of their samples about a decade ago, after the publication of a book, Darkness in El Dorado, that questioned the ethics of the researchers who collected the samples. While the holders of the samples haven't fought the tribe's request, the logistics of collecting and shipping the samples back has taken years to sort out. Kenneth Weiss, a geneticist at the Pennsylvania State University, accepted the samples years ago from his retiring advisor, James Neal, who wanted them preserved. The samples had been collected by Neal and cultural anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon from the Yanomamo in Brazil and Venezuela in the 1960s and 70s. They've been stored since then in labs around the United States.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. For more about these stories of the Yanomamo and Havasupai tribes, see the June 4th and April 30th issues of Science. Billions of years ago, when our sun was forming, scientists think that there were other stars forming nearby with their own protoplanetary disks and comets whizzing about, similar to our own. But in a paper published online by Science, Hal Levison and colleagues suggest that our sun may have captured some of the material circulating about these other stars, particularly the comets that make up the Oort cloud at the gravitational boundary of our solar system. The research suggests that studying the chemical makeup of these Oort cloud or long-period comets, comets such as Halley's Comet and Hale-Bopp, may give some insight into the composition of these other stars, now scattered around the Milky Way. I spoke with Levison from the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
We have new numerical models concerning the origin of what we call long-period comets, which are some of the brightest comets in history. And what we're finding is that these comets probably formed in the protoplanetary disks of other stars and were captured in orbit around the sun early in the sun's history.
What had been the model for how these long-period comets formed?
Previously, it was thought that these objects formed in the protoplanetary disk of our solar system as the planets formed and were gravitationally flung out of the system as the planets reached their full mass.
And what evidence or data prompted you and your team to question that model?
The simple explanation for this is that when we sit down with our computers and try to model in detail the formation of this population of comets, which we call the Oort cloud, it just fails. We don't get enough stuff from the protoplanetary disk of our solar system into these distant orbits.
And the more complicated?
There's a population of objects that have perihelion near the orbit of Neptune, but have very large semi-major axes. And we believe that these objects were scattered outward by Neptune, essentially. That we call the scattered disk. It's usually lumped in with the Kuiper Belt, but it's probably more appropriate, when you think about it from the point of view of formation, to be lumped in with the Oort cloud. So the objects in the Oort cloud today, according to the standard model, went through the scattered disk before they got to the Oort cloud. Now, we believe the Oort cloud is the source of these so-called long-period comets. But the scattered disk, we think, is the source of a type of comet that we call a Jupiter family comet. Okay, although these things tend to be a little fainter, so they're not as famous like Halley or Hale-Bopp, the comets that we have flown spacecraft by have all been Jupiter family comets. So that we can use modeling techniques that use the number of long-period comets that we see and estimate the population in the Oort cloud. And we can use the number of Jupiter family comets that we see to estimate the population in the scattered disk. And the number that we get from these calculations has a ratio of around 700 to 1 in favor of the Oort cloud. But our models of formation of the Oort cloud and the scattered disk predict a ratio of 10 to 1. So it's almost a factor of 100 in the sense that the Oort cloud is much more populous than the theory would predict, according to the scattered disk.
So how exactly does your team's model, that our sun captured early on comets from other stars, account for this discrepancy that you mentioned?
So when we discovered this inconsistency, the first thing we tried to do was to beef up our standard models of Oort cloud formation, try to find dynamical pathways where we could build a more massive Oort cloud from our protoplanetary disk. And my team and I spent, 5 years trying to solve this problem and couldn't. So we decided that what we really needed is another source for the Oort cloud. Now, the idea that these guys were captured from other stars actually dates back to the early 70s. But the calculations they did then showed that the process was much too inefficient to explain what we see. But it turns out that they couldn't do the problem right, because computers weren't good enough at the time. And so when we did it, we found that the capture efficiency was large enough to explain the Oort cloud that we see.
So this builds off of previous models of solar system formation by first trying to boost up the Oort cloud itself, the mass in the Oort cloud, and then saying, well, that mass must have come from somewhere else because it couldn't have passed through the scattered disk.
Yep. And so, I mean, the idea that we captured the Oort cloud is not really a planet formation model. It's a solar system formation model in the sense that we're looking at the behavior in these new models of stars moving around in the birth cluster and comets being ejected from those planetary systems and how the whole system evolves as a whole, right? That led us to the idea that a comet floating around in a cluster that got ejected by another star can find itself bound to the sun when the whole system evolves away.
Where are those other stars now?
Those other stars are just random members of the galaxy. We couldn't recognize those stars even if we tried. The sun has gone around the galaxy roughly 20 times since it's been born, and the other stars, they all started off in a clump, but they've been following their own orbits since the cluster went away. So it's going to be almost impossible to identify those particular stars.
Does this model suggest that scientists may need to revisit other models of how the solar system formed in the first place?
I think a better thing to say is what this work is going to do is going to lead us to the understanding that we can perhaps use these comets to understand what the star cluster was like in which the sun formed. Believe it or not, we have very little information about what that star cluster was like, since we can't identify any of the stars, and some of them are halfway across the galaxy, frankly. So we don't really know much about this, but these comets may be able to tell us something about it, and that's one reason why this is such a cool result.
So would we expect great chemical variation from these comets as compared with the Jupiter family of comets that were thought to have evolved around our sun?
I think the answer to that is now we have to ask the people who actually study comets. The difficulty is that these stars that gave birth to these comets are the sun's sisters and brothers, right? They formed out of the same cloud that the sun did. So maybe, you know, to first approximation, you wouldn't expect very many differences between the comets born in their disks and the comets born in ours, because it really is just basically the same stuff. But there have been some papers written that argue that the chemistry in the disks themselves could be different depending on the kind of star you're around. And so I think the thing to do is to put together people who think about disk chemistry models with the people who study comets. Right? One of the things that happen a lot, particularly in this kind of thing, is that the observers go out and they observe their comets and try to fit what they see into the standard model. And what this paper is telling them is that the standard model may not be right, and they may have to start looking elsewhere for the answers to the differences they see. So it sort of opens up a new realm of parameter space for them to think about, at least.
Hal Levison, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hal Levison of the Southwest Research Institute is lead author of a paper on the capture of the sun's Oort cloud from stars in its birth cluster. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org.
In the past few decades, there's been a lot of talk about long-distance contact among peoples from different continents. And one of the most intriguing questions is, did the Polynesians, the great seafarers of ancient times, did they reach as far as the coast of South America?
Science contributing correspondent Andrew Lawler reports in this week's issue on how archaeologists are finding new evidence that Polynesians reached South America before Europeans did.
And this has been a hotly debated question, and in the past couple of years, there's been lots of new research that shows that, in fact, it is possible and even likely that Polynesians voyaged on canoes all the way from the central Pacific all the way to the coast of South America.
Why has this evidence only come out in the past few years?
Well, a few decades ago, in the 1950s and 60s, a man named Thor Heyerdahl, a famous explorer, he set out on a raft that left South America and crossed into Polynesia. And his theory was that, in fact, the Amerindians, the Native Americans of South America, had traveled to Polynesia, taking with them things like the sweet potato, which was domesticated in the Andes and then appears later in Polynesia. Many people thought that this was a nutty idea, really, because there was no real evidence of the kind of sailing technology necessary for the Native Americans to have made a long voyage across the sea, whereas the Polynesians, who had moved east over many centuries, did in fact have that technology.
Beyond that technology, what are some of the other lines of evidence in support of the hypothesis that Polynesians sailed to South America?
Well, scientists have long known that items like the sweet potato appeared in Polynesia sometime before Columbus. And other things like gourds, tomatoes, other things that are native to the Americas are also found in Polynesian archaeological dig sites. So this left a lot of archaeologists scratching their heads, saying, well, how did it get here? For a long time, there was a belief that long-distance travel was not very common until the time of the European sailing ships. But over time, we've learned that the Polynesians, in fact, were extremely capable of traveling far distances without using modern technology, and Polynesians had settled most of the Pacific very quickly. In fact, by around 1200 AD or so, most of the major islands of the Pacific were already inhabited.
But going from island to island is different than heading all the way to the coast of South America, isn't it?
Well, that's true, but Easter Island, which is very, very far to the east in the Pacific, is only, say, 1,500 kilometers or so from the coast of South America, which in Polynesian terms is not that far. You've got to remember that this is the largest ocean in the world, which is speckled with a very few islands, and that for the Polynesians to get as far as Easter Island was in itself a technological triumph of major proportions. So to postulate that they made it as far as the South American coast is actually not such a crazy idea, particularly given this new evidence which is surfacing, using DNA evidence, for example, to trace how sweet potatoes and other substances, plants and animals, worked their way into the Polynesian settlements of the pre-Columbian period.
Are the genetic studies, these DNA studies, convincing?
Well, the sweet potato DNA studies are probably the most convincing, and they haven't been published in detail yet, but researchers in New Zealand have been working on it together with some Japanese researchers to track the movement of the sweet potato over many centuries. The sweet potato has a particularly complex DNA, so that makes it a little bit easier to follow the changes which happen over time. And what researchers have found, and this is still unpublished data, but it was presented recently at the Society of American Archaeologists meeting in St. Louis at a session I attended, they actually have found that the strains of sweet potato that are found in Polynesia more closely match those of South America than they match those varieties which the Europeans took from South America and took to Southeast Asia in the post-Columbian era. That's pretty good evidence that somehow the sweet potato, which requires humans to plant it and to grow it, it can't just wash up on your shore. In fact, you have to have humans who understand how to use the crop. It's pretty good evidence that, in fact, somehow the Polynesians were able to get a hold of this very important tuber at a very early date.
What form of evidence are scientists hoping to find that would really convince everyone that this actually happened, that this hypothesis that Polynesians sailed to South America is true?
Clearly, what would clinch the case is finding settlements and human remains that clearly are from Polynesia on the coast of South America. And there is some intriguing evidence that, in fact, this is very possible. It may be possible to find this data. There is a group from New Zealand, together with their colleagues in Chile, who hope soon to be able to dig on Mocha Island, which is located just off the coast of Chile. And there is some evidence that some of the human remains found there have Polynesian characteristics. Now, there's not DNA evidence yet to show that. They will need to be able to find human remains and animal remains and be able to carefully study them and be sure the data is not contaminated, the DNA is not contaminated, in order to show that, in fact, there is Polynesian DNA in those remains. Also, finding a settlement with Polynesian characteristics and with Polynesian-style artifacts would be excellent evidence that, in fact, the Polynesians did make the long journey, not just to the islands of the Pacific, but all the way to the great continent of South America.
You said hoping to dig. What's been the holdup?
Well, the New Zealand archaeologists and their Chilean colleagues are moving very carefully because there's a lot of sensitivity in the Native American community, both in South America as well, of course, as in North America, about digging up human remains. So the archaeologists are working closely with the native inhabitants and trying to explain what it is they want to do and make it clear that what they want to show is the diversity and the technological and cultural contacts that the ancestors of the people who currently live on the coast of Chile once had. So in order to get that approval and to have everybody on board, it's taking some negotiation and some time, and there's great sensitivity around skeletal remains of people's ancestors. So the archaeologists involved want to move carefully, but they're hoping that by the end of this year or next year, they will be able to actually begin excavations, the first scientific excavations on Mocha Island, which could provide some really important data about whether or not the Polynesians, in fact, were able to cross the world's largest ocean.
Andrew Lawler, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Rob.
Science contributing correspondent Andrew Lawler reports in this week's issue on how archaeologists are finding new evidence that Polynesians reached South America before Europeans did. Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how mongooses transmit culture. I didn't know mongooses had culture, Dave.
Well, a lot of people didn't. And in fact, Rob, people usually attribute culture to more, shall we say, intelligent creatures like humans, primates, even whales and dolphins. Mongooses aren't traditionally thought of as part of that elite group of bigger thinkers. But this new study shows that mongooses, despite their small size and relatively small brains, do have as much culture potentially as some of their bigger brain counterparts.
What is the culture and how is it being transmitted?
Well, mongooses have this really unique social system where when the pups emerge from the den, instead of pairing up with one of their parents to sort of learn about how life works, they usually pair off with an older sibling or a cousin or an uncle who essentially becomes their escort or chaperone during their infancy. And this escort protects them and feeds them, even plays with them when they grow up. And part of this relationship involves a chaperone essentially teaching the mongoose how to obtain food. And in a specific example, and you can actually see videos of this on the site, a mongoose will say when it's eating a hard shell prey, like an egg or even rhinoceros beetles, to get at the gooey center, as it were, the mongooses will either bite into the item or they'll hurl it against a hard surface to smash it open, or they'll employ some combination of the two. But usually when they pick one method, they stick with that method through their whole life. And the researchers wanted to see when these pups pair up with their chaperone, do they learn the same technique that their chaperone uses? And that's what would essentially be evidence that culture is being passed from one generation to the next.
And this is happening in the wild, these experiments?
Yeah, it is. And the researchers actually watched 42 pups and their escorts over the course of several months. And what they found was that indeed, when an escort tended to employ one particular strategy for getting these hard shell items open, the pup would employ the same strategy. And even a year later, after the pup had long separated from the chaperone, the pup was still using that strategy, indicating that a piece of mongoose culture had been passed down.
So are researchers saying then that we shouldn't think of culture then as something that's only limited to big-brained animals?
Exactly. They're saying if these intellectually unspectacular creatures like mongooses can pass down culture from one generation to the next, that means a lot of creatures that we usually associate maybe with lower intelligence or just don't put on the same pedestal as we do with humans and primates might be capable of sharing culture as well. And after this study, scientists will probably be looking at a lot of other animals like this to see if they too pass down culture.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from tracking culture to tracking mosquito slobber, this next story is all about how the spit of mosquitoes can be used to help predict major disease outbreaks.
Where are researchers collecting this spit?
Well, they're collecting it from traps that they set for mosquitoes. And these traps are essentially filter paper covered with honey. And mosquitoes like to eat sugary things. So what the mosquitoes do is they fly onto these traps and they feast on the honey. They tend to be very sloppy eaters, so they spread a little saliva around when they do this. And the researchers are basically trying to figure out, is there something in the mosquito saliva that will help predict disease outbreaks. The real problem right now is when mosquitoes carry a lot of diseases, they carry malaria and dengue fever and West Nile virus. And all these viruses present in different ways. Some of them tend to affect the same area over and over again. Some of them pop up in new areas. And usually by the time they've popped up, it's become a major health problem. And researchers are really trying to figure out with this new study, is there a way to sort of figure out, you know, when a disease is going to strike an area next? And that's why they were turning to this mosquito slobber. The idea would be that these viruses that these mosquitoes carry, the RNA in these viruses, the researchers might be able to collect them from the saliva that the mosquitoes are leaving on these traps or in the wild, maybe on a piece of fruit or other sugary substance, and be able to tell what disease might be coming.
So normally the researchers look at the mosquitoes after an outbreak has already started to happen in a human population?
Well, there's a number of ways they can do it, and all of them have problems. They can gather up mosquitoes, but as you can imagine, that's very time and labor intensive. They can take samples from people, but again, by then it's really too late. And so the idea is there a relatively easy way to find out what's coming?
So how much more efficient then are these honey-laced traps compared to these other traditional methods?
Well, honey has a lot of advantages. First of all, it's antibacterial. So when the mosquitoes leave the viruses and the RNA in these viruses on the trap, it's not going to get eaten up by bacteria. Also, these traps can be left out for more than a week, and they can be set over a really large area. They're speedy. They can be collected and analyzed very frequently. There's just a lot of advantages of doing something like this. And overall, these traps are effectively cutting in half the amount of time researchers would theoretically need to detect and respond to a disease outbreak.
Well, with all these advantages, is this going to start being employed all the time, everywhere?
Well, critics still point out that there's a cost factor here. It's not free, as you would imagine, to put these traps over a very wide area. Collecting them and analyzing them still does take time and money. So experts really want to make sure that this is going to be an effective approach before it's disseminated widely. And there's also the hurdle of convincing other researchers to adopt this technique. Again, the researchers are really going to have to prove efficacy in a real-world scenario to convince a lot of people that this new technique is worth trying.
Because the cost of conversion from the traditional methods to these new ones is also a consideration.
Exactly.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from mosquitoes that cause disease outbreaks to black holes that can destroy planets and even the planet-forming process, this last story is about powerful jets that are emitted from black holes and solving the mystery about why these jets form in the first place.
What are these jets?
Well, Rob, every massive galaxy has at the center at least one supermassive black hole. And these are black holes that can pack essentially billions of suns into a space no bigger than our solar system. And what happens is these black holes tend to spin around, and they have this so-called accretion disk, which is sort of a disk of matter that surrounds the black hole that also spins. And what researchers have noticed is that these black holes essentially spew these high-speed particle jets from their north and south poles. You can actually see a picture of this on the site. And the jets are essentially like cosmic tsunamis. They sweep away everything in their path for hundreds of thousands of light years. So anything that these jets are aimed at, even dust and the gas that normally would have congealed into stars, is essentially destroyed. And this jet is almost sort of like an eraser for the universe. Anything in its path is essentially wiped out.
Do all of these supermassive black holes in galaxies emit these jets?
No, and that's the mystery. Researchers know that some of them emit very powerful jets, some of them emit less powerful jets, and some of them emit no jets at all. And the question has been, why the discrepancy? Well, some theorists have proposed that the jets might be caused by the black holes rotating in the opposite direction as the accretion disks and their surrounding galaxies.
Is there any way to measure that in particular?
Well, researchers can look at radio emissions to tell which way a black hole is spinning. And when they did this survey of a bunch of the black holes that are out there, they found that black holes that were spinning in this so-called retrograde fashion were the ones that were producing the jets.
So opposite the direction of the rest of the accretion disk.
Exactly.
And so what then causes the different power of these jets? How fast they're spinning?
Well, the researchers actually trace this back to Einstein, and they say when the black hole is spinning in an opposite direction as the accretion disk, it has effects in terms of relativity and warping space-time, and it's creating basically these massive amounts of energy that are expelled as these very deadly and very powerful jets. And so the idea is those that are spinning less fast in relationship to their disks and surrounding galaxies are going to produce less powerful jets.
Is it the accretion disk itself that's slowing the black hole down?
That's what actually what researchers think is happening. What the researchers found is that in a lot of these younger black holes, and these are the black holes that are much farther away, the ones that are spinning in the opposite direction of their accretion disk are emitting the powerful jets, but that over time, the accretion disks exert enough force on the black hole to essentially slow down that spinning and reduce the power of those jets. And therefore, a lot of the much older supermassive black holes are not emitting these powerful jets as the younger ones are.
So the ones that are closer don't have these jets.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how moons may still be forming in our solar system. We think of all the bodies in our solar system having formed billions of years ago, but it turns out there's some moons that may have formed even only a few million years ago. And also a story about the genetic basis of autism. Turns out it's a lot more complicated than researchers have thought. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about science education in the U.S. and how budgetary funding is affecting that. And also we're continuing our very extensive coverage of the oil spill in the Gulf. We're asking five major questions, including what's happening to the oil, what's happening to coastal ecosystems, what's happening to marine life. Be sure to check out all of this coverage on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the June 11th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.